Hi, I'm Betsy Scott with the Housing Innovation Alliance, coming to you live from St. Louis, MyTech's corporate headquarters. Thanks to MyTech for letting us share your space as we're visiting the local market and looking at innovation and action out in the field. We're going to talk about the intersection between industrialized construction and ESG metrics in housing. I think both things have been talked about a bit independently for a while now, but we see that there's an opportunity to synergize these two advancements in the housing industry and that they can both benefit from each other. Perhaps driving ESG will help drive industrialized construction adoption. And if you industrialize your construction process, whether it's in the field or in the factory, I think there are also expanded opportunities to get to higher levels of performance in housing and community development. So the first person that you're going to hear from is Nigel Watt. He's with RIA. And Jack Oslin, who's with Diamond Age. Both of them are really going to focus on industrializing your construction process in the field. And then you'll also hear from Edwin Tatum of Tatum Tech and Paul Grahovac of BuildSmart, who focus more on the offsite construction side. So at a very high level, we're going to be looking, as I said, at on-site solutions and offsite solutions and how they can help drive metrics in these three areas. This is how we as the Alliance look at ESG. Really being a good citizen of the planet, being a good community member, and a more responsible business. And we think there are a number of metrics that really industrializing your process and your product can help you drive, with the ultimate objective really of driving greater business resilience. We're seeing a lot of investors and a lot of municipalities looking for projects in home and community development that deliver more in these areas. We think it's going to be a prerequisite for access to land and capital in the future. Welcome, Nigel. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to see you.
And Nigel's with RIA, and Nigel and I have a history. Yeah. You've been in the industry for 35 years in product development, first with GE Plastics.
Yeah.
And then we had the good fortune of working together at Ibicus, and you worked on what many builders and developers will know today as the Perform platform within Ibicus, helping production home builders. And now you've taken a solution that was developed at Ibicus with the Department of Energy to really advance, if you look at HVAC as a component, to really advance that and, you know, make it more of an industrialized product and process. Yeah. So can you give us a 30,000 foot view of how your technology products and processes are helping industrialize at least part of the home construction process and what you think is kind of the inspiration behind that solution?
Yeah, I'll start with the original inspiration, and it kind of goes back to Ibicus. This was fundamental research that Ibicus had been conducting over the years as kind of part of their real passion and mission to push the industry forward to build ever more energy efficient homes. They've been on the cutting edge of that for a long time, along with other building science companies doing similar work. But the work that we did, supported by the DOE's Building America program, was really kind of fundamental to the birth of our small diameter air distribution system, which we call RIA. We launched RIA as a company end of 2019 after that long R&D phase that we did within Ibicus, and managed to raise funding from seven of the top 10 production home builders to get the company launched. Our approach has been twofold. It's a kind of a physical and digital solution. So our secret sauce is really the hardware and software engineering that makes it work with conventional equipment and conventional HVAC equipment. And that equipment is typically specified by production home builders today. So that was a key aspect of what we needed to do to make it work. We use our engineering know-how to combine with injection molding technology to mass produce the thermoplastic duct connectors, the takeoffs, the boots, and diffusers. And the result is a small set of components with integrated features that assemble quickly, are aerodynamically efficient, and quiet in operation. So as a package, it works extremely well. And we have to make all that work within a kind of cost and margin that works for our customers, for distributors and builders and contractors. And then in parallel with that, the kind of digital side of it, we produced and engineered a solution to take those components and be able to design them in a way with conventional design principles to quickly create a home run duct layouts, and to then take that design data and output it into our balancing app. And we use this app through the field technicians' work to balance every installation quickly and accurately to the design intent. So we get a high performing, predictable, and well balanced system when it's installed in the field. So Rear, after 10 years of R&D, really has a strong energy efficiency component along with labor savings and addressing code challenges, and really to make the biggest industry impact possible. We work closely with our investor builders. They construct a large percentage of the 3 million homes being built this year. And we're now kind of past that startup phase of the company, and we're now in our kind of early rapid growth stage.
So if you're looking at it, to sum it up for people, you might say that you guys are the PEX plumbing type plug-and-play solution for air distribution and housing.
Yeah, you're right. That's a common analogy we take because of it's a simple concept for most, you know, anybody who's in the home building industry, I think, is now familiar with PEX plumbing, and they went through a journey that we're going through now to make change in the industry and adopt a new technology.
So you guys represent you can have an impact on a big system within the house, but the principle of what you guys are doing is something that people could take in the field in general and just look at different aspects of construction and how can they industrialize a piece or a system within the home. So I think that's a unique play that you guys have. So a good step forward can be made in each area and get some good incremental wins. So thanks for the overview. We'll bring back in a few. And we'll get more into some of the specifics of the metrics that you guys are looking at and how you connect it back to ESG. So the next person that we're going to bring in is Jack Oslin, and he's with Diamond Age. He also happens to be in the Phoenix market, so I'm sure it's super hot there as well.
No shortage of heat here.
So, Jack, you have more than 35 years focused really on the manufacturing side, so high volume manufacturing and supply chain management. This is your second venture-backed startup that you're working with, and your goal really at the 30,000-foot view is to automate construction in the field using robotics. So you're kind of our second solution really for industrializing on-site. So how would you sum up your technology approach and kind of the secret sauce to your process that you think will make a difference for people to industrialize what they're doing and to move forward metrics like we look at in ESG?
Yeah, sure. So I'll start with the motivation or conceptually what drove the concept of the business. So our entire founding team comes out of factory automation, a variety of different factory automation settings. So I came out of the print and packaging world. Russell came out of the beverage packaging world. Phil came out of integrated circuit boards. The team effectively all coalesced at Tesla, where they started building electric vehicles together. And so when we look at solving the problem and recognizing the sort of lack of coordination and collaboration that's attainable today because of the large variety of trade suppliers that come in and out of a job site, we looked to our factory operation experience and said, well, how do factories operate? Well, factories operate on a very specific tempo using a manufacturing execution system. There's generally vertical integration inside of a factory. So all of the operations can be predicted in a very reliable way, and all of the assets can be managed in a very reliable way. So when we looked towards how we were going to do it, we knew we had to bring our technology to the field. It wasn't going to work in a centralized factory. So what we've done is we've built out an automation platform that will offset 55% of labor required to build a new home. And we do that by taking a basic gantry system and setting it up around the concrete foundation on the job site. We have seven matching gantry systems that will all share a common suite of end-of-arm robotic tooling. And so the objective here is to create an assembly line in the field so that we can drive down cycle time and increase the utilization of all this capital expenditure that we're putting forth in the creation of the robotic platform. So since a house is too big to move, what we do is we move the tools around the job site instead. So you can imagine having a series of seven gantries all set up, you know, kind of juxtaposed to each other. And the first tool goes into play, fulfills its job, and then moves to the next gantry and starts to do that all over again. Well, on the first one, the second tool comes into play. And then we just start leapfrogging the tools around from gantry to gantry. And that allows us to keep creating value in a sequential, ongoing basis. So the Diamond Age robotic platform will always be building seven houses simultaneously. And that will get us onto this cadence of ultimately delivering a home every 5 days. So this assembly line concept, sort of the early milestone value that we're going to deliver, is that we believe we're going to deliver single story homes in 30 days and two story homes in 45 days. And that everything we've heard from the market is that would be a remarkable advancement and be extraordinarily helpful, both from the perspective of driving down carry cost, but also delivering a more predictable and reliable delivery schedule. You know, anybody who's run a large business understands reporting. And if you're at the head of a publicly traded company, the difference between delivering a home on March 31st and April 1st is a big deal. So these are the kinds of value propositions we're offering the industry, coupled with the fact that this is robotics as a service. We're not asking anyone to buy technology or license it or even run it. We will bring it as a turnkey solution where we will be the owners, operators, bringing the tech, bringing the people to run the tech, and then bringing the tradecraft labor required for the high value finishing. That will all be vertically integrated and owned by Diamond Age. So it's a little bit of a throwback concept to the way houses used to be built before the whole trade supplier ecosystem evolved. But we think it's a winning combination today. And we're getting ready to demonstrate that this summer. We'll deliver our first home the first week of August to Century Communities, and we'll have two more in various stages of production. So we've sort of extending an open invitation to all home builders to come down to Phoenix and have a look for yourself.
And we're hoping to do that with you as well. We've got you potentially lined up depending on where you are in the legal process. How many people can we bring to you? But when we're at EBA in September, we're hoping to do that with you as well. So that will be exciting to see in the field. And we'll talk to you again in a little bit about your personal inspiration for how you came by that solution, as well as how it's a bit different and why it's a bit different than what most people are thinking of in terms of 3D printing. Because a lot of people have heard of you as a 3D housing provider, but your take is quite a bit different and why. Yeah, yeah. So we'll touch on that.
We're much more, for sure.
Yeah, we'll touch on that a bit in a moment as well. So thank you for that overview. That's very helpful. The next person I'm going to bring in, we're going to move toward offsite construction solutions. So I'm going to bring in Paul Grahovac from Build Smart. Paul's out in Kansas City today, not too far from us, a little west from where we are in St. Louis, but we met several years ago. Paul is with Build Smart and its parent or sister company that does a bit more of the technology, but we're focusing on Build Smart today and the expertise that you have. You bring a unique background, I think, to offsite construction in that you were litigating risk issues in building before you were actually building housing. So I was
personally in my career, not my company.
Now you were putting the screws to people a little bit, catching them on their quality issues. But that gave you, I think, a good background to see what could be done better. You say a lot of people see you as the guy, the air barrier guy in the industry, but you're really looking at wall systems, wall assemblies, and really taking that to the next level from a performance standpoint and looking at passive house. So as one of those metrics. So if you could give the Build Smart snapshot of what you're doing from a technology perspective and kind of what's the inspiration behind that solution, that secret sauce, that would be great, Paul.
Okay. Yeah, I had mentioned to you previously that it Build Smart and Prosoco, I'm known as the air barrier guy. Prosoco is a 90-year-old family-owned construction products company, leader in the air sealing and water-resistant barrier field, all fluid-applied products. President is David Boyer, KU School of Architecture, 79, and also the president of Build Smart. And it was his inspiration, having built homes of his own, including a SIPS home that he did not quite find satisfactory. Then coupled with one of our customers at Prosoco, Adam Cohen, an internationally recognized design, build, high performance contractor architect. The idea that Adam had and was actually doing with his business was prefabricating conventional wall panels, lumber and OSB, and then shipping them off to a SIPS factory and having EPS and another layer of OSB laminated onto that. Because if you go to these high-performance conferences, that's what people are calling for. Oh, I wish we had a wall assembly that was conventional wall on the inside and more like a SIPS assembly on the outside. And so that's what we went to business with. The idea is that, you know, one day there will be a major revolution in construction, and it'll probably be somewhat slow in coming. And so we wanted to be sort of the first or one of the first incremental steps that the builders and designers and developers could take to start down that important road to go down. This makes it much, much easier and faster than stick building a conventional wall. And also much easier than doing a high-performance wall. There's a great article in Fine Home Builder magazine, April, May 2021, about the 2021 code. You may not have it where you are, but it is worth following because it calls for external insulation in almost all of the climates. And it does that for prevention of mold. And even though your main goal may be code, you want to be looking at mold issues. 75% of houses have mold, and it's a liability issue you can avoid with external insulation, which is much easier to do if you use a prefabricated system. The other goal was to have the shell put up, as I said, by people quickly and easily. One of our projects in the urban core, the developer general contractor there went out in the street and hired people who not only had no construction experience, had never had a job, and put these in at 31 lineal feet per hour and passed the blower door test with no leak chasing on a 40-unit apartment building. So that was part of the vision. The other part of the vision was once the shell was up, all the other trades could come in on the inside and outside and have no idea that they were dealing with an advancement in technology, because everything that they see and work with is just as if a conventional shell had been a stick built there.
So really, I think a key thing and really a reason why that we asked you to join us today, we've seen a number of panelization companies, and I know that's not the word you use wall assemblies, but we've seen a number of panelization companies that don't do beyond just the frame. And I think I think the direction that we need to go in order to get the true value out of doing things, if you're going to do things in the factory, is to incorporate more of those systems, get more of the efficiencies in the factory. I think the solution that Nigel represents in RIA, I think they're also looking at how does it work in the field? How does it work in the factory? And I think he can speak to whether they've gone the factory route yet, but I know that was a consideration. But yeah, I think we could do more with more in the walls and think of it truly as the manufacturing process to really leverage that. And you guys represent a bit of that with what you're doing already.
Yeah. And along those lines, I didn't mention, we install in the factory the windows and airtighten and waterproof them so that when you get your shell up at 31 lineal feet per hour, you're dried in. You know, you set a roof on it and you're good for all your interior work. And, you know, you miss a snowstorm or a rainstorm, that could mean weeks. So.
Right. Well, I appreciate your overview, and we're going to introduce our last panelist before we open things for questions. Edwin Tatum from Tatum Tech to the table. And Edwin, you're in Dallas, right?
I am. It's very hot, but I'm here. Phoenix, though.
So you're an enthusiast on the real estate development side. But it's a relatively new thing for you, you know, over the last probably 10 years or so. You were originally a professional basketball player.
I was in my former life. I was, that was many years ago, and now I need a lot of WD-40 to play. So I'm a little old, but that is correct. I got in the industry around 2010 and started doing traditional stick build, individual fix and flips and things of that nature in the Dallas, Fort Worth Metroplex. So during that time, became very, very both frustrated and fascinated in construction. And so the inspection process, quite frankly, was a huge nuisance for me and gave me a lot of headaches. And I was just, you know, wondering, why are we doing it the same way we did when Andrew Jackson was president, right? I just didn't understand that. So coming from the entertainment area of the world, I think it gave me a bit of a perspective to say things can be different. It allowed me to question norms that I think probably an industry incumbent wouldn't, or if they did have those same frustrations, they didn't want to project them. And so giving this sort of fresh perspective, it allowed me to go on this curious journey over the last 10 years and then ultimately form my company 3 years ago.
And you've done what a lot of people do in our industry who are looking at more modern methods of construction and really looked to Europe and explored and became a student of what's going on overseas and how much farther they are along their journey in offsite construction. So glad to have you representing the volumetric modular part of the discussion today. And I'm going to bring everyone else back into the group. I wanted to get a sense from each of you, really, who moving forward do you see as your ideal customer? So for those on the phone who might be looking for a partner or looking for a solution to build homes or, you know, deliver multi-plan or master plan communities or do community development, who's your ideal customer that you would work with in the residential space? And if you can reiterate for everyone where you are on your journey in terms of scale, just at the high level. So we'll go to Jack. We'll mix things up to go to Jack first to reiterate that, and Edwin and Nigel and Paul. So Jack, who's your ideal customer? And remind us of where you are on your journey at this point in time.
Sure. So We literally are at the beginning of our journey. We've spent the last 3 years developing technology, and we've just recently rolled it out commercially in a development for Century Communities. So our customers are production home builders. Production home builders align with our mission. Our mission is to get first-time home buyers into their first home faster. So in order to do that, they are the perfect platform because all of the experience and infrastructure around building volume already exists. So for us, our alignment with them is really less about disruption and more about unlocking growth. We're not here to change the way homes are designed. We're here to change the way homes are constructed. So tract housing suits us very well. And our systems are built to build volume. So again, just to reiterate, we started our first commercial unit beginning of June, and it will be ready for viewing beginning the first week of August. So we've got a long way to go. It's a big undertaking, as you might imagine, changing the way homes are built and consolidating the back end of a supply chain that's really sort of been perfected over the last 100 years. There's a couple things to do.
Now, you do have investors, though, who are on the builder and development side. So they are actively working with you to collaborate and to give input on the development of your solution. That's true, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, Century has been an amazing, I mean, they're less a customer and more of a partner. They have, you know, early on, they recognized the potential for what a Diamond Age system could do for them as well as other production home builders. And they followed our progress really from the very beginning. We met them at an Alliance event back in Scottsdale.
Well, there you go.
Say 2018. And so it's been a very close relationship over the course of the last 3 years. They did make an investment. We received investment from BB Living, which is also a large build-to-rent developer. And we have Hillwood Communities has made an investment. I'm sure a lot of your folks know those guys. Mm-hmm. As well as a big land developer out in Charlotte, North Carolina, so who controls thousands and thousands of lots. So, yeah, I'd say we're in a pretty good position. And, you know, again, it's always incumbent upon us to keep advancing the business and proving that what we believe to be true to be actually true.
So, Edwin, on your side, who would you be your ideal customer? You're in the DFW market, looking to maybe branch out into other markets as well?
Yeah, so I would certainly echo Jack's sentiments in that we're extremely early. However, we've gotten a lot of traction in a couple of different places. One, single family built for rent. There's been a lot of activity as it relates to our solution with those types of investors, as well as your production home builder or production developer. Land developer, and then your multifamily developer. We also do volumetric modular construction for multifamily. And so those three sort of principal types would define who would be our perfect customer. And as we expand to the East Coast, we'll probably have three facilities in the next 18 months, two here in Dallas, and then one on the East Coast. And so we want to get as close to our customer as possible. And so we look at, you know, macroeconomic data as it relates to specific MSAs, and wherever there's a delta or a strong need for attainable housing or multifamily, we try to look at that area to invest.
Nigel, how about on your end?
Yeah, for us, you know, the top production home builders are our customers. And as I mentioned, seven of the top 10 of those invested in us. So it makes sense, obviously, to work with them as quickly as we can. And really, you know, when we think about it, our ideal customers are are the leading contractors and distributors and builders who have that kind of attitude and approach to want to change. That attitude really smooths the adoption process, allows us to expand into a market through their additional builder customers, if it's a contractor or a distributor. And for us, you know, we've passed through that startup phase. We did a lot of pilot homes right in the middle of the pandemic of 2020, just to make it interesting, and got through that phase and went into full production ramp up last year. And right now we're targeting around, well over 10,000 installations in 2022. We're actually past that tracking past that mark right now. Depends on what happens to the market towards the end of the year, but we're doing well there. And, you know, in the end, we're just trying to impact as many homes and homeowners' lives as possible. Obviously the investor builders and their contractor distributor suppliers are the ones to work with.
And currently, you know, Alan Lang joined you. A number of people in the industry would recognize his name as mm-hmm. Ben, which I think gives you guys a leg up as well as having been a leader on the operations side, executive side within production home building companies. You know, and Taylor Morrison, just to name a couple.
Yeah.
So, so certainly having that kind of bigger builder board and then having the leader who has the expertise, you're not just drinking your own Kool-Aid. You actually have some really good feedback on how it's going to work. So I think that is certainly important for buy-in and important for getting the solution off the ground and really taking advantage of it. So you're not new to this neck of the woods, Paul. You guys have been doing this for a while. So where are you in your process and your thought process, and who's your ideal customer at this point?
Well, we've had to enlarge our tent a little bit from what we first envisioned. Our current clientele, if you will, are custom home builders whose clients appreciate energy efficiency, a house pumped full of fresh, virtually allergen-free air, and being able to withstand a polar vortex if the energy goes out. Those and multifamily projects in the low-income housing tax credit program, and we have a repeat customer in the private sector, where they reward energy efficiency. Our ideal customers are production builders, because that's where prefabrication really can pay big dividends instead of every house being a one-off like we're doing now, although we're set up to do that. We have a custom builder in Kansas City. Most of our projects have been in the northern quarter of the U.S., northeast quarter, quadrant, and Ontario. But we have a custom home builder in Kansas City, a certified passive house builder, who has done production building and wants to get back to it and wants to use these panels to build energy efficient, high quality housing for the missing middle that is currently underserved. Mm-hmm. As to scale, basically my research and word of mouth has been that the only time that wall panelization has caught on is when the builders have initiated it themselves and set up their own shops. And our mode of expansion is not by setting up our own factories around the country, but rather by supporting builders and others who want a bolt-on business that they can have there locally. I contacted a bathroom pod prefabricator, and I said, you know, I want to buy a couple of pods here for a investment project I'm working on. They said, well, no, we only supply complete apartment complexes. I said, why is that? And they said, well, we don't have a factory. We build a pop-up factory wherever there's going to be an apartment building. And the same could be said for the footprint that we have for this system and the ability to supply a development or a city.
So you're, if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that you can kind of license your approach.
We would consider ourselves a hub of a spoked wheel, and basically do all the work like the others, we've had to invest in to figure out how to do this, keep it here, and then put the easy stuff out at the end of the spokes for the people that want to use it and get on with building.
Okay, that's fair. I know that attainability was is a core to what you're looking at, Jack, and you shared an interesting story about your frustration and kind of what inspired you. So if you could share what inspired you to get into Diamond Age, I think that would be a great way to start kind of talking about the potential to take what we see as really a social aspect of ESG and drive it through an industrialized construction approach. And, you know, attainability is something that we would agree with you on, that you said on the missing middle. There is that need. What can we do through industrialized construction to deliver more housing that is suitable and can support more of those middle family incomes? So, Jack, tell us your story.
Yeah. My origin story is pretty personal. For everybody on the call who has not started a business, let me just tell you that it's hard. And it's one thing to start up a lifestyle business like a corner market or a dry cleaner. It's another thing to take large amounts of industrial capital from professional investors. That is a whole nother level of hard. And so I don't recommend it unless you have enough sort of personal passion to carry you through all of the intensity that is building a business. And mine actually came from an experience I had with my son back in 2017. He called me to tell me that he was getting ready to move his family because they couldn't afford to buy a home in the area. And as you might imagine, in that moment of rage and despair, when a father hears his son telling him he's going to move away from him, I got sufficiently pissed off enough to start a business. I don't do venture-backed startups for kicks. They are really hard. There's a lot of lost sleep. There's a lot of tension that you bring home into your family. So I don't take it lightly. And so the necessary emotional drive was born out of my son's announcement that he was moving away from me. And I was, quite frankly, out of touch with housing. I hadn't bought a house for 30 years. So I didn't really understand the scale of the problem. And when I dug in, it became clear in a hurry that something had to get done, because we're not just talking about my children, we're talking about everybody's children. And then once you get past that, you're talking about the entire ecosystem of housing, renters included. So, you know, that's what sort of got me over the hump. And it got me far enough along, Betsy, to put down $250,000 of my own capital just to figure out if there was something worth pursuing.
Right.
So that's the origin story of Diamond Age. And I was just fortunate enough that I had enough good friends on the technical side of things that when I went to them and said, you guys should all leave your cushy jobs right now and go on this journey with me, because I guarantee you that you can work 6-7 days a week and have a 90% chance of failure, but you should do it anyway. And they did. So that's how we got there.
So Edwin, how does attainability factor into your priorities on the volumetric modular side?
Number one, I would say, speak subjectively, I come from low income as a kid, and I grew up in Section 8 housing. So I'm acutely aware of the product, let's just say, in terms of your first time home buyer or, you know, your low income house, single family house. And so when I got into, after my professional basketball career, and I got into building myself, you know, one of the driving forces outside of the frustration with just the overall process was, how can we innovate the process to be economic enough to where people can have quality homes that they can attain? I think it's a travesty that a firefighter or a nurse or a teacher can't get a home in the United States right now. And so at least our team is dead set on focused on that problem. We have about, 65 years of specific offsite modular manufactured housing on our board, 65 years of experience, and then another 100 years total of construction experience. And we're trying to use all of that institutional capital to say, well, what are the best ways that we can advance the program? One, to make our direct customers' life easier, meaning our home builders and developers, but then our indirect customers, meaning the people that will occupy these homes. How can we make this more cost efficient in the best way possible? So that's, it's certainly a subjective and a personal drive from the lack of things that I remember as a kid. And hopefully the next generation won't have to suffer those issues.
Have you found specific metrics that you're looking to move that are going to help bring costs down? Or are you still in the ideation phase on that at that point?
No, I think just our process itself, because we're able to, one of the things that we don't want to do is we don't want to over index on technology. I think that's a fatal mistake in terms of, Elon Musk learned that with Tesla when he tried to automate his entire factory. Now, we do think that there's a tension between automation and utilizing human capital, right? And so in systems where, we need to, OSB is heavy, right? And so we want to lift OSB, we don't want a human doing that for 8 hours a day, right? We want to bring in a robot to assist them in that process. So what we've seen is we're able to cut labor about 20-25% in certain facets of the production line that drives down costs both directly to our customer and indirectly to the end user. Now, I don't have any pricing control when it comes to our customers, so I can't promise you anything, but I can say when we deliver to our customer, they are getting savings.
Okay. Nigel, how about on your end from an attainability perspective, cost savings perspective?
Yes, that's interesting points that Edmund made there. I agree with. And, for us, the labor issue has always been one of those big cornerstones of why we're doing what we do has been for a long time. Labor shortages are just prevalent. They have been for many years. I don't think that's going to go away. So for us, we've been looking carefully at how we use the technology of designing the system and the home run approach and the plastic components and how you can actually integrate features and benefits into those components and the way they go together to make it quicker and easier, make it easier to put a system together. And we've seen labor savings, easily at the 50% mark in many cases. Depends on where you are in the country and what the system is. But, when you talk about cutting a day or a day and a half out of just the HVAC rough installation part of the equation, builders care, right? That makes a difference to them. And it gives the contractors an opportunity to do more business, to do more work. If they can't find people, they're limited to how much work they can do per crew. But if we can increase that by 50% or even 100%, then that makes a big difference. And for us, that's been one of the driving factors.
Is there an overlap between or another opportunity as well in the material usage in addition to with your solution in addition to labor?
Yeah. Well, one aspect of the system that we have is it's very compact, right? So it's easy to move around. We can get pretty much all of our componentry on a 4x4 pallet without any trouble at all, the ductwork and all the components. So, getting that to the job site is a lot easier. Shipping and freight, that makes that easier as well. And then just the fact that it's, they're small parts, you can handle them very easily. You can install and assemble them without worrying about cutting your hands or getting mastic all over your and tape everywhere. So it just becomes a more pleasant experience for the contractors. And for those installers in the field, we get a lot of feedback on how they love to work with it because it's just quick and easy. And it just makes it, they're not crawling up in attics trying to manipulate large insulated duct that has fiberglass floating around and all of that's gone. It's very clean and almost high-tech in a way from their perspective.
Paul, how about on your end with your wall assemblies? What are you looking at in terms of attainability and cutting costs or adding value into the process?
Well, there's some great articles out there that builders ought to take advantage of. on the subject of total cost analysis, you know, there's two buckets of money that you save with prefabrication. The National Association of Housing Finance Agencies says you save 20% on the assembly itself. But then there's the other costs and savings. While the site excavation work is being done and the foundation is being put in, the walls are being fabricated in our factory, whereas normally you have to wait sequentially until the foundation is up and cured before you can start even building the wall. And so that sort of thing brings on tremendous acceleration of construction, and that greatly reduces the amount of interest on the construction loan. And the National Association of Home Builders has found that prefabrication reduces waste by 30 times. And I'll tell that to contractors and they'll say, great, that's 30% decrease in waste. I said, no, that's 2,900%. That's 30 yeah. times. and I'll say, when you figure the comparative cost of prefabrication, do you figure in the utilization of dumpsters at $800 a week and all that waste you're managing? Right. Not to mention your fellow contractors that'll help you fill it up after hours when you're gone. So there's two buckets of money, and anybody in prefabrication or considering prefabrication needs to carefully look at both.
So anything to add, Jack, on the attainability side? I want to go back in a moment to the higher level of ESG and see what other metrics you guys are trying to move. But wanted to go back to you since you started with a personal story. Do you have metrics that you're, you know, big targets that you're looking to hit from an attainability perspective?
Well, certainly. I mean, for in the world of automation, you're replacing labor, right? So, you know, we look at our model that, you know, we're replacing 55% of the labor required to build a home. And it's mostly rough in and a little bit of finishing work. But we should be able to replace that with like $11,000 worth of automation cogs. So, I mean, there's a straight up savings there. You know, a radical reduction in cycle time should have immediate impact. And then, you know, as any technology company scales, you generally find that there are step changes in your business that you get from scale, whether that is within the opportunity to build the systems cheaper, or just it's really all the things that you don't know that you don't know. Those things start to uncover themselves. Yeah. And we built our first demonstration home last October, November, out back of our shop in Northern California. And we had, I don't know, we had 15 engineers and five fabricators all crawling all over the site, you know, watching the equipment run. And they put down thousands of strings of concrete and they're all watching this thing, and it never ceased to amaze me. Like every 30 minutes, two guys would look at each other and go, I didn't see that coming. And like, how could you not see that coming? You've been doing this for 3 years. Theoretically, you get in, you start producing a real floor plan, and you start getting things at height. And all of a sudden, you know, empirical knowledge takes over. So, you know, we'll learn 100 things every day for 100 days. And that's when things will start to improve and start to drive cost out. Today, you know, if I'm being brutally honest here, I don't even know how many guys are going to work on the automation team and on the tradecraft team. I mean, we won't know that till we've got probably 30 houses under our belt. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these are the things that all technology companies go through. You can project to the best of your ability. I tell every investor that I send my model to, all this proves that I can do math. It doesn't. I haven't built 100 homes yet. So I think transparency is the only way to get this thing done. And that sort of aligns with ESG there, Betsy.
Absolutely. But I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you look at this, no matter which approach you guys are using, because you have it, you're looking at systemizing it, it should change the nature of the labor that you need as well.
Well, in our case, that's absolutely true, because we will be effectively taking our tradecraft labor and boiling it down to a task orientation. So I won't require a whole fleet of electricians that know the entire ecosystem of electricity. You know, I can take young people out of high school or vocational schools or JCs, and I can have an experienced electrician teach them how to terminate electrical outlets and switches and putting in can lighting and the like, and then put them out in the field attached to a mentor for X amount of time so they can get a lot of reps. And then I'll take that same person and bring them back in, and we'll have an experienced plumber teach them how to land a toilet and make, you know, sink connections and the like. And we'll do that wash, rinse, and repeat. And it's literally the exact same process that the automotive industry takes when they put associates on an assembly line. You get certified in 12 to 18 different tasks, from putting in a steering wheel to putting on, you know, left quarter panel to putting in the passenger side seat. And you receive a certification. And then when you go out into the field to do that job, you install that product for 2 hours, and then you stop, and then you change tasks. And it prevents repetitive stress injuries. It keeps people's interest higher, because they're not putting steering wheels in for 8 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. The same thing holds true in construction. If all I'm doing is putting in light switches and terminals, terminating, you know, outlets, you know, I'm going to burn out after a while. So it's how we keep people cross-trained. They become more valuable to the business. The jobs are better for them. And quite frankly, it's higher value work, because all the crummy work goes to the robots. All the higher value work goes to people. We can pay them a little higher wage. They get a little higher job satisfaction. It's really a win for everybody.
But it also expands your ability to have people with different skill sets, ability to have people with different educational backgrounds, ability to have people, you know, women.
This has already been a boom for women. We do extraordinarily well hiring women into Diamond Age, because we just offer them the promise of, you know, as Edwin says, nobody schleps around an 8-foot sheet of OSB at Diamond Age. You know, the work that people are doing is more rewarding work. So, you know, if you are a, you know, if you're a 5'4" female, Diamond Age has great work for you. And it has a pathway to even more interesting technology oriented work, driving a robot. We have women on staff who are electrical technicians who build electrical panels and maintain robots out in the field. I mean, these are all jobs that are way more interesting. No offense to guys who swung a hammer for 20 years, but I would say it's more interesting than swinging a hammer for 20 years.
Well, and I think with the younger generations coming up, it will be more appealing to them, because there is the technology aspect to it. There is the, you know, it is more of a cool, potentially opportunity for them to use different technology platforms, robotics, et cetera, to deliver housing. So,
absolutely. You know, this manufacturing execution system that we're deploying out in the field, as my children tell me all the time, we're the generation that's not afraid to push buttons. And so, if you can imagine, Betsy, that you show up and you get a yellow vest with RFID tags on it and URL codes, and you get an Apple Watch that will communicate out to you as you are moving through your job. Mm-hmm. It will be telling you what's coming up next, when it's coming up, what it'll be, where you should be, approximately how long through geolocating it'll take you to get from this place in your job site to the other place in the job site. And oh, by the way, you'll be passing by the construction trailer, pick up two boxes of, you know, number nine screws that, and hand those to the maintenance supervisor when you get there so he can load up the next tool. These are all the types of efficiencies that young people are not afraid of. They actually appreciate having more information pushed out to them in real time. So they can do their jobs better. There's a greater sense of accomplishment and integration in the success of the overall process project.
So there are some comments that we get here. I want to make sure that we share some of these. So Frederick said it was interesting what you explained, Paul, about integrating more value into the wall prior to delivery on site. So you should catch up with him offline. He's kind of giving you an open invitation there. Nigel Johnson, he asked, Edwin, is the 20% in labor reduction primarily due to prefab solutions, or are there additional ways that your company is using automation or technology to reduce labor use in development?
The answer is yes. So I'll just say a combination of both. For instance, I didn't mention this earlier, but the commodity of choice for us is steel, cold form steel. And so through the use of technology, in our experience, with the machines that we are using to produce these housing plans, we reduce our framing labor by more than 25%. And so what that does at the ability to produce 3 million square feet a year, that those savings are automatically given to the customer in their final price. And so just in our framing machines alone, you know, we're able to produce at a significant clip to where we can pass those savings on both to those indirect and direct customers. So great question, but that's just one area that we use technology to reduce labor.
So Damian says, to maximize the true benefits of offsite, embracing a turnkey volumetric modular system implemented correctly can tick so many boxes. He agrees with you about getting the balance right with manual labor, and automation is key. And we found that in a number of, we do a lot of site tours. We're actually going to Mattingly Lumber and Millworks tomorrow here in St. Louis. So it'll be interesting to see the strategic decisions of incorporating or not incorporating automation. You know, when are those capital investments? When do those make sense? Both to the process and to the value that you're delivering, certainly in the field. With your approach, Jack, they make absolute sense. But yeah, in the factory, what is the right level of automation? So that's a very good point to make. Frederick asked you, Jack, with automation, how is it possible to get custom houses? Do you see any innovation or solution coming? He says maybe he means from the car industry in terms of custom houses.
Yeah. So if you think about the way that Tesla sells cars now, it's not much of a leap to think that that's the way that Diamond Age will offer houses in the future. So if you want a Tesla, you have to go to the website and you have to design your own product from a configurator model. And configurators are not that difficult. It's really, I think the term is curated customization, meaning that you have a set number of choices, whether it be, you know, four floor plans and maybe three different exterior elevations, a couple of different paint colors, et cetera. And then you just start picking and pulling those down and building your own product. And that becomes accretive to the home builder as well, because they have designed the community already. There are X number of floor plans. There are X number of elevations. There will be Y number of paint colors. And so this will just be a way for home buyers to access the offering from the home builders in advance and build their own product, if you will. And the great thing about configurators is every choice you make impacts the price. So you'll be able to see that price change before your very eyes. Now, based on the economic conditions, you might have to hurry to transact because the interest rate could change tomorrow. But nonetheless, there is a way to sort of sift through all of the different optionality and arrive at a product price point. So these are some of the things that we look at that we, again, not to disrupt production housing, but to be accretive to it and help take some of the friction out of the process for them. So the closer we can help the end buyer, you know, the home buyer and the home builder get to each other, the better it's going to be for Diamond Age.
So Dennis on our team said, great to see these pathways to improve process productivity and performance. What call to action do each of you have for the industry to accelerate adoption of new concepts and to work with you guys moving forward? So Nigel, if you want to jump in on that one, we'll
yeah, that's a great
call and circle around.
That's a great question, isn't it? We have so many of those on our list based on the last couple of years of experience. Maybe if I could wave a magic wand, I would say if we can all together, and in particular looking at the home builder, think about systems approach to costing and evaluating a new technology. We often, because we are essentially a replacement to a conventional system today, we get a lot of comparison pricing, right? It's like, well, what's your system parts cost versus that? You have a lot more duct and therefore it's going to be more expensive. And, you know, getting them to look at the whole picture is quite hard. Now, some of the smarter builders we work with there, they know how to do that and they're figuring that out. And then they go beyond that, looking at the value. Well, what can we do with this value? What can we do with a better performing system? What can we do in the way we market the products, we market the house? Can we push more of a message of energy efficiency or comfort or whatever it may be? And also on the contractor side as well, what can they do to sell their solution to the home builder? Thinking about it from a more of a systems approach perspective, I think that's a critical one moving forward, and I think that feeds into everyone else on the panel as well, and the way they want the builders to look at a new solution. You can't just look at it as a price to price comparison. It's got to be, you got to look at the whole system and the whole solution. And if you do, and add on to that, you know, what incentives are out there from state and federal level to do this, to build more energy efficient homes? There's lots of benefits there on the financial side as well.
Well, and your developers or your performance metrics that you're supposed to hit may focus also on healthy homes, you know, from an ESG perspective. Right. So, you know, what is the pain point you're trying to solve? Not just what is the direct comparison of cost. How does it get you to deliver on the promise that you're looking to deliver and deliver that value? Exactly. So Paul, how about on your side?
Well, you just, you raise the healthy home issue. I mentioned previously, you know, virtually allergen-free homes filled with fresh air. People who are window openers stop opening their windows because they realize the air is just as fresh in these homes as the air out on their porch. And, you know, you get an energy recovery ventilator. Heck, I figured out at Lowe's down the street, you can pick one up for $450. So this is not rocket science, you know, strange, odd technology that's being foisted on people. This is the future is here.
Edwin, you're shaking your head.
I think he's right. You know, both had great answers. You know, for us, it's, you know, having the incumbents look at the bigger picture from a comprehensive perspective, in that it's not just an ESG thing. It's not just a financial savings tool, but, you know, it's what value can we get so we can pass that on to our customers? And in our opinion, prefabrication and modular construction, particularly because we're building to the same code, right? We're building the International Building Code. I mean, it's been around, right? This is nothing novel Even manufactured housing has been around for 100 years. The only thing we're doing, to Jack's point, is we're layering technology in places that it makes sense to augment human capital, not supplement human capital. And then we're saying, hey, this is a guaranteed delivery date. You don't have to worry about change orders anymore, because once we start going, there is no turning back, right? And so planning will be very, very critical. I think that's the biggest pain point we have with our customers right now, is getting them to understand the planning involved with our architectural and engineering team as it relates to shop drawings to whatever they've designed. The end product won't change, but the process to get that end product does change.
Anything to add, Jack?
My advice to the industry is always, you know, it's the definition of insanity, right? If we do the same thing over and over and over again, we should expect the same result. And so today's environment is not sustainable. So whether it's Diamond Age factory in the field, or whether it's Tatum Tech building modular in a factory, I would encourage all home builders to look at, you know, innovation in a broad lens, and then evaluate it as it pertains to your own business. And then back something, right? I mean, sitting on the sidelines will get you absolutely nowhere. And, you know, a partner like Century Communities, they are the complete opposite end of the spectrum. They're super aggressive. They're putting big money down. I know D.R. Horton and Lennar has put big money forward. So these are companies that are moving the needle. And then it's really going to be incumbent upon the companies, us, to go out and prove it. And it's why my deal with Century was, I will take your money. I'm happy to take your money. But it comes with a string or two, because I have to serve the entire industry. I can't just serve Century Communities. So I need you to look at this as a larger investment, and not as a way to wall off Diamond Age solution for yourself. And, you know, it wasn't hard to get them to get there. I think that the production housing industry has some of that co-opetition going on. So, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. So, again, for the industry, you know, find your spots and back somebody. You know, take a little bit of a risk and get in the game.
Yeah, and there are a lot of interesting solutions out there with potential. And as an industry, we underinvest in innovation. But I think, as you were saying, co-opetition, seeing those eight bigger production builders, I think you said eight, Nigel, who are backing RIA and investing in it because they know that it's going to benefit them, and their money goes so much farther when it's lumped in with other investors who are also have an interest in the solution. So that's great advice. I don't know that we have any final questions, but if we hear anything from you guys, we're going to continue this in the longer term. This will go live as an archive directly on our LinkedIn. So we'll follow what the comments are, and we'll try and engage people in follow-up discussions on this standpoint as well. Both industrialized construction and ESG are ongoing topics for us. How can we improve the design and build process? How can we leverage and understand what's going on in terms of ESG, which encompasses, as we've seen so far, a lot of different metrics that we've already been looking at as an industry. But I think by it being a buzzword now, and an area in which people are pushing some innovation, there's an opportunity to move things forward. So thank you guys for your participation today.
Thank you.
And we'll connect with you again soon.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.